This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following sponsors. Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes that there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. Streaming right now on Shudder, you can catch up with Joe Bob Briggs in The Last Drive-In, see originals like Cold Hell or Sadako vs. Kayako, and the upcoming One Cut of the Dead. You can stream all these great thrillers, horror, and suspense movies for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fast, and growing human-curated selection of thrillers and dangerous entertainment anywhere. They are the Netflix of horror. To try Shudder for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast. That's S-H-U-D-D-E-R. And use the code WAVES. This episode is also brought to you by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD right now. They've got awesome releases from Vinegar Syndrome, including Darkroom, The Suckling, and Grandmother's House. All of the AGFA and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Bloodlake, and Lady Street Fighter. From Garage House Pictures, both Supercock and Foes. And also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head over to www.diabolikdvd.com or search them out on Facebook. Fangoria. In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world, and now this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. That's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want you to experience this and have it be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. We're celebrating in style. Head over to fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. And if you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, which is issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off at fangoria.com. And Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror section at your local video store. Not those big, brightly lit stores like Blockbuster either, but the hole-in-the-wall shops. The shops where you could find deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to video hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that is dripping with sloppy, ooey-gooey 80s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by the New York Times bestseller author Cullen Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by the legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Saltaris, rising star Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedell, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker Award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic today to unlock all the super rad stretch goals exclusive only to the Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter in June. And remember to always be kind, rewind, or die. Head over to Kickstarter.com right now and search Graveyard Slaughter today. Hello, we are Shockwaves, and welcome to our live episode from Chattanooga Film Festival. I assume you guys know who we are, but if not, I'm Rob G. That's Elric Kane and Rebecca McKendry.
Hello. Hi.
And we were. I'm happy to report that Elric has not vomited yet on this festival trip.
It's not over.
It's Saturday morning, so there's still time. We're going to bring up briefly before our very special guest. We're going to bring up a friend of ours who literally just took the gum out of my mouth and threw it out for me. So that's what kind of man Dave Lawson is. Come on up, Dave.
Dave Lawson.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Oh. You can sit right here.
Ew. Dave is touching Elric's face. It has been done.
Now I'm drunk.
What all have you done since you got here, Dave?
Well, I'm trying to see if I can find the bottom of Chattanooga whiskey. So far, I found a lot of them. And it's going well.
Have you seen anything?
Yeah, I saw a lot of things. I saw myself as an elf last night.
Which was amazing. There was a lot of chest hair involved.
I can't help that. That's just... Like Lady Gaga said, I was just born this way.
Nice. So you had your D&D game.
I did. We had a live D&D game with Cargill, who DM'd, which is like that was such a treat because he built such fantastic worlds. So that was a lot of fun.
And another great podcast after this podcast here is Junk Food Cinema.
Oh, yes.
Hosted by them, which is a great show. So,
can you pass the whiskey?
Yeah. Sorry.
And that sums up the weekend.
Hey, guys, I'm Dave Lawson. Thanks.
Well, for people listening, they might have heard it last year. Just explain your relationship to this festival, because this festival is incredible. It's a total labor of love by both the Dorches at the back.
Chris! Yes!
CD1 and CD2. Yeah, yes.
But you've become part of that family, so explain a little bit of that.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate that I've had some films that have played a bunch of different festivals, and there's something just really special about Chattanooga Film Festival. The people that work on it the blood, the sweat, the tears that goes into it is unmatched, and they really know how to treat guests. And it's always a lot of fun and something different. And I was just talking with Charlie earlier. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure. You can kind of decide exactly what path you'd like to take. And I just really appreciate what they've cultivated here.
And sometimes the whiskey chooses the path.
I mean, mostly
for you, mostly.
Yeah.
The elf costume, I think, a little.
Just... No, that the elf costume was purchased sober.
Okay. Okay.
I made a conscious effort to wear that without a shirt. I don't know why.
It was a proud day.
Jeremy Gardner couldn't be here for this one. He's acting in at least two films here, Fingers, Sadistic Intentions.
Yep.
But he's also been helping him make his dream film.
Yeah.
The last couple years.
Yeah, we announced it last year here at CFF, and then we went and made something else, him and his co-director, Christian Stella. And it was one of those shoots where you walk away, and sometimes you walk away and you're like, oh my God, that was the worst. But it was one that walked away from immediately and just had the most love. Sorry, I didn't mean to pound on the table there. The most love for like the experience. Chris Dorch, CD2 actually came out and helped on the shoot, which was really fun. So it really was. It was just like going to an abandoned house in the middle of Leesburg, Florida, which is peak Florida. It's as Florida as Florida gets. Don't go there. Sorry.
Hands up from Florida today.
No.
Oh,
just one.
Florida is fine. Leesburg is not.
Okay. So when can people expect to see it? It's going to play
it's
at Tribeca.
Soon, right?
2 weeks. When does the podcast come out?
We don't know.
Mystery.
Oh, so
depends if this was recording. This could just be an ephemeral thing. No one ever gets to experience, but we'll see.
It's experiential.
Yeah, exactly.
So we premiere opening weekend at the Tribeca Film Festival on the 24th. And then we play the 24th, 25th, and 26th. Or 25th, 26th, 27th. Whatever Friday, Saturday, Sunday is. So we're really, really excited about that. It was... You know, I don't know how many of you have seen The Battery? Okay.
Yes.
Everybody that put that didn't have your hand up, that is your homework for next week. Go watch The Battery.
It is currently on Shudder, right?
It is. Yeah. Plugging sponsors. That was unintentional. It's one of the most amazing films, and the fact that they did that for $6,500, which if anybody's made a film, that is... I don't understand how they made it, and I make low-budget films. So I saw that, and we just kind of fell in love with the two of them, and it was a real treat to bring something else to life.
Cool. And for people who don't know, your company is with Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson.
Yep. So. Rustic Films. We started that about a year and a half ago officially, and then Something Else is the first one we put out under the banner, and then we just finished Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead's new film called Synchronic, which we shot down in New Orleans. So it was really good. That was really fun. That'll be the second one out, and then we'll probably have some real big news that gets announced right after this.
Oh, sweet.
Right after this festival. And then hopefully, there's a Rebecca McKendry project announced.
Nice. Ooh. What?
Jeez. Nice.
And anybody that's a fan of Moonshine will love this one.
What?
Moonshiners. Okay, so people can see you later today at the pitch session. Tell us a little bit about that pre-split.
Yeah, so... Basically, one of the hardest things that I've learned in this business on both sides of the table is how to pitch. So Rebecca has been gracious enough. She's going to come up with me. She is going to pitch a film, and we're going to kind of dissect her pitch a little bit and explain, you know, where I think the pitch went wrong and where she lost me.
Wait, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah, no.
Oh, you're getting notes.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah, you're getting notes.
Cool.
I told you this. You just don't remember. And then anybody that has a project that they want to pitch and come up and, you know, we'll do live workshops in front of people. The only way to get better at something like that is, I mean, you guys know, mm-hmm. talking in front of people, the only way to get better at it is doing it.
Keep doing it.
Yeah.
Whiskey.
Yeah, have some whiskey.
Yeah, exactly.
Have some more whiskey.
All right, cool. I think that.
Well, thank you so much.
Guys, I got to leave. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So wait, when does something else, do you guys have distro plans secured yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
So if you have deep pocketbooks, just
coming
go ahead.
Soon.
Yeah, coming soon at some point. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, Abe.
Enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
See you later. Where'd he go? Oh, he's still there.
You guys all
breakfast.
Have mono now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about that.
Worth it.
That's what you think.
So for this event, we decided to have two special guests. One just happened to be at the festival. He was on our show earlier, God, maybe a year or two ago now. I can't remember. But it was episode 57. After this, Elric is going to introduce his film Vice Squad, which I know you're excited
about. Well, I'm hoping
about.
Gary will introduce it with me. Because you have a lot more to say than I do. I'm just excited about it.
You're going to Q&A that. That's
okay.
So Gary Sherman is here to join the podcast. And also,
hello.
I'm very excited. This is one of my, if it's okay to call you, it's one of my oldest friends in Los Angeles when I first moved there. And I grew up a huge fan of this guy's films. I was like 13 when I went to see Leatherface Chainsaw. I snuck into Leatherface Texas Chainsaw 3. And we've always wanted to have him on the show.
We've been talking about having him on since Killer POV days. Mm-hmm. Like, it's
very,
literally
yes.
been like 6 years.
And finally, welcome Jeff Burr to the show. Thank you for joining us, guys.
Yeah.
And also, you guys don't really know each other. This is probably one of the first times you guys are going to get to chat with each other. We like pairing.
Well, we did. We were out in the lobby for about half an hour.
Yeah. So it was great.
Waiting for us.
Up on a lot of stuff. But I just got to say about Dave, you know, I don't drink. And Dave does. So Dave's been following me around all over the festival because every time somebody hands me a bottle of whiskey, I give it to him. So
designated drinker. Yeah, so just to kind of warm up a little bit, because I think one of the – we're going to just have a broad conversation about everything. Mm-hmm. But Elric had pointed out that the both of you guys have been responsible for some pretty radical, crazy sequels. And we're big fans. We grew up on those sequels.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll delve into that a little bit. But, you know, first let's just talk about who you guys are. I mean, Jeff, we've never had you on the show. You know, you've done a lot of really cool sequels, including Leatherface and Pumpkinhead 2, which
Pumpkinhead
I do like.
Puppet Master
4 and 5. But also some really great original films. The anthology From a Whisper to a Scream is great. Scream Factory did an incredible release of that. Eddie Presley, which is one of your personal favorites. Straight Into Darkness. There's some good stuff in there.
Thanks. But
Yeah, I made my first movie about 30 miles away from here. So Chattanooga's always been a special place in my heart. And Chattanooga, growing up in Dalton, Georgia, in the 70s, there was really you had to travel to discover these great genre movies. And so I remember seeing Phantasm here in Chattanooga because it didn't play in Dalton and stuff like that. So Chattanooga's always been a big part of my cinematic going experience.
All right. And did you always have an affinity for the horror genre, like when you were growing up and just getting into films?
Sure. Absolutely. There was a my story is like so similar to so many, it's going to sound like an incredible cliche. It's like you see the we had a horror host in Chattanooga called Dr. Shock, and they had the Universal horror package, and they would show some outre stuff too. They sometimes they never looked at the movies they showed, so I remember seeing it showed at 11 o'clock on Saturday. And so seeing an uncut, this is pre-cable, pre-everything, uncut John Ashley, Mad Doctor of Blood Island with full nudity. It was amazing. So that Dr. Shock was a key part of the equation here for horror. Right. But I mean, I always loved, not necessarily just horror films, but stranger movies or non-mainstream stuff, and also regional films, because our drive-in in Dalton got every regional horror film made, or regional, you know, moonshine epic or whatever. I always liked the handmade kind of quality of those kind of movies, because you felt they were not made kind of manufactured in Hollywood.
Right.
So it was always interesting to see those strange movies that until recently haven't been revived, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Gary, who was your horror host? Was it Sven Gulli?
No, it was Marvin.
Marvin?
Where were you at, okay?
Shock Theater.
Yeah.
Where's this at? Oh, Chicago.
Chicago, okay. Yeah. He wore these Coke bottle glasses, and he wore black turtlenecks and black jacket, and he would show, you know, all the old Dracula and Frankenstein movies on set, also on Saturday night. I used to work there. You know, but it was my brother. I had an older brother. He was like 6-7 years older than me. And his favorite thing was to scare me. So my revenge was to scare the rest of the world. I used to watch Shock Theater religiously. And then, and also, I bring up my brother again. He took me to see The House of Wax in 3D.
Oh,
and I was like way too young to go see a movie like that. And it scared the fuck out of me. And that just really became my thing. I mean, I used to have nightmares about Charles Bronson. and of course Vincent Price. But that was really my earliest entry into the world of horror. And I think we talked about on the previous
episode.
Yeah.
Episode about my whole fixation about serial killers.
Oh, that's right. Because
there was one in Chicago
active
when I was growing up, and I used to wake up screaming in the middle of the night thinking that he was outside my window.
Wow.
And he was killing children.
That's intense.
Dark times.
Yeah. Was there one movie in particular that kind of pushed you guys both to want to work in film? One thing that you look back on and was like, well, that was the turning point?
Do you want to take
that? I mean, I was, you know, 7 years old when it came out, but 2001 had a incredible effect on me and kind of haunted me. So that's one of the movies that truly made me want, not necessarily made me want to make movies, but certainly made me love movies, for sure.
Mine, two words, Roman Polanski. Mm. From the time, I was in college, I started watching Polanski films and some of his early Polish, you know, films that he made in Poland, and I was always just fast. I mean, and then Rosemary's Baby, which I still think is probably the best horror film ever made, ever. To me, if you watch it today, it's like it was made today. It hasn't aged a bit. And just when I was in pre-production on Deathline, I went to I went out to I'm trying to remember which studio it was, Elstree in outside of London to meet with Jeff Foote, who was going to be my editor on Deathline, and we went to talk about what we were going to do. And I get there, and he's having lunch with Alistair McIntyre, who was one of the other great old-time British editors. I mean, both of them, their resumes were unbelievable. And so I said to Alistair, what are you doing? And he says, oh, I'm doing Macbeth. And I said, Polanski's Macbeth? He said, is there another Macbeth shooting? And I said, oh, my God. I mean, that. Oh, my God, because Polanski was my God. And he said, and he's going to be here in a minute. He's having lunch. We're having lunch. Anyways, Roman shows up, and he said, well, let's all have lunch together. And there I was sitting there about to direct my first movie at, you know, 24 years old, and I'm sitting there with Roman Polanski, who had also directed Donald Pleasence. And we sat there for an hour and a half talking about directing Donald Pleasence.
Oh, wow.
And a movie called Cul-de-Sac, if you don't know, if you've never seen it, see it. Pleasence is amazing.
And yeah, he showed up having a shaved head, which wasn't part of the plan for that movie. Right. He just showed up.
So
and
striking.
Polanski was like, okay, yeah, roll with it.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I was in, if I would have died right then and there, that would have, well, actually, no, it was a few years later.
Hold off on that.
I'm in Los Angeles and I'm having breakfast at Nate Nell's, the deli in Beverly Hills, with Jay Cantor, who had produced Deathline and was now president of Fox. And so, anyways, everybody comes and says hello to Jay, and boom, somebody leans over Jay, over my shoulder, to say hello to Jay, and Jay says, oh, Roman, do you know? And he looks at me and he says, Gary Sherman. I couldn't believe he remembered me. And he said, I saw Deathline and I loved it.
Oh, aww, that's great.
Oh, that. Wow.
And Roman Polanski had just told me that he loved my movie. And those are the words he used. And I just said, okay, I can die now. That's it. I don't have to live another day of my life.
Wow. For Jeff, what was your first film? Was it From Whisper to Scream or The Offspring?
Yeah, that was my first feature film, yeah.
And, I mean, obviously I encourage people to check out that disc because Daniel Griffith did a really incredible documentary how you and Darren Scott and a lot of you guys pulled that movie together. But I want to tell our audience, give them a little sample of, you know, what was it like making that transition? You've been a fan of movies, you loved filmmaking, here was your shot to make something, and it was actually an anthology, which was, I don't know if that was popular at the time to do horror anthologies?
I don't think it was based on the box office results of The Offspring, but it was not a cynical decision, but a practical decision. We thought we could attract a better cast if we kind of the amicus, Max Rosenberg, Milton Sabotsky model, where you could get a guy in a leading role, but only have to shoot him for a week.
Right.
It was important for me to have a really, really strong cast. That was always a goal of mine for that movie, and we got very lucky and got some amazing people in it. Clue Gulager and Cameron Mitchell and Vincent Price, of course, Susan Tyrell. So just it was a real mix of Rosalind Cash. So that's why you kind of decided to make an anthology, and the city of Dalton really got behind the shooting of it. But it was my first movie, but it wasn't my first movie in my head because I had started making Super 8 movies just like you guys are making digital movies, starting at probably age 13, 12, and literally, I'm not kidding you, those movies are just as real, if not more real, to me than the so-called professional movies.
Right.
So in my mind, I wasn't a first-time director, even though, hell yes, I was. Believe me, I was. And you thought you knew certain things, and you didn't. And so every film is a learning experience, a huge learning experience, and that was an exceptionally huge learning experience for me, but it it was a very low budget movie, and we got, as I said, very, like, the cinematic gods were shining on us on some level, and certain things were a little more difficult than they should have been. So very much a typical first movie, but it was a totally independent movie. Totally, no one was asking for this movie, and it didn't have a release date. So it was an uphill battle to get people to see it. God forbid now it would be, I mean, because at least back then, if you had a finished film in 35 millimeter, everyone would see it. They would watch it, and for distribution, at least watch it. And now you have to literally have a gun to somebody's head to get them to watch something that they don't know about.
Yeah, it changed a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, wow.
You know what? The bottom line on making movies, if you have a good script, that's where it all starts. You have to have the script. And if you have the script, you can get the cast.
That's an incredibly good point.
And then, you know, making the movie, whatever you have, if you have $10, or if you have $10 million, if you have $100 million, you know, you just make the movie that you can make for that amount of money. But if you've got the script and you've got the cast, you get in there and you make a movie.
What was the biggest learning curve for both of you on the first film in terms of sharing with, like, people who are interested in making that first film? You're talking about going through making movies in your head, making movies on Super 8, but then there's obviously this leap, a couple big things being, like, scheduling. Like, suddenly you're shooting for 18 or more days,
yeah,
or
exactly.
is it having to answer all this army of humans looking to you? Yeah. Like, what were the things that might help somebody?
Well, yeah, like, we had a relatively small crew for that movie, and maybe 25 people, which is a big crew now, you know. But for me, and it doesn't exist now, so I don't know how much this would be helpful, but the logistics of shooting in 35, because we were shooting on a Mitchell BNC. This is something I would say don't ever do. Don't hire a director of photography just because they have the gear. And that was a somewhat of a mistake. It'd be like hiring a writer just because he owned a typewriter back in 1985. That's kind of what we did. And the problem was, if you do have problems with him, you can't fire him. You know, he'll take his football and go home. Yeah. You know, so we're in Dalton, Georgia. You know, we can't. There was very little equipment available at that time. So anyway, so that would be a very solid rule: don't hire someone in any capacity just because they have the gear. There's got to be a sensibility that's matching yours, and a work ethic that's matching yours too.
There's nowhere to go from there. No one can top that line. Don't hire a writer because he's a typewriter. I love that. But, I mean, you know, I don't know. I just I was making commercials. I was I had a very successful career doing commercials when everybody kept saying to me, make a movie, make a movie, make a movie. And I lived in England, and in London. And there was a lot of crossover between the commercial world and the feature world. I mean, Ridley was doing commercials then, and I mean, everybody that was doing commercials in London was looking to do a feature, and doing it. So I was on a shoot and sat down with the writer from the advertising agency who had just written a great novel, and said, I have this idea, and I pitched him the idea for Deathline. And
was it Raw Meat or Deathline when you pitched it?
It was Deathline. It wasn't Raw Meat until Samuel C. Arkoff got his filthy fucking hands on it.
Elric's what we call
it. Sold the damn movie, Gary. Come on.
No, it didn't. It did a lot better in Europe than it did in the United States. Raw Meat never... When Raw Meat was released in the United States, it did nothing. Robin Wood, you know, the great film critic, he did an article in The Village Voice, and they got published everywhere. Actually, somebody just sent me a copy of the article. Anyways, he said in the article, don't go see Raw Meat. Wait till you can see Deathline.
Yeah. That's good.
And he said, he called the name of the article was Butchered.
Mm. Oh,
that
wow.
They took Deathline and turned it into Raw Meat. I mean, Raw Meat was not my movie. Now, when Raw Meat got when MGM released the DVD in 72 or 73, 2002 or 2003, that was Deathline with Raw Meat put on it as a title. So, you know, I don't think anybody in this room has ever seen Raw Meat, and hopefully you never will. They AIP had cut it to pieces. The tracking shot's not in it. I mean, which is, you know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, because just following up on the directing question, I think you guys have worked with so many different types of actors, and even just your anthology. You're talking about Susan Tyrell and Clue Gulager. I mean, you know, and we love Clue from back in L.A., but there's just so many different personalities to manage. I'm kind of circling the Wings Hauser part of this that we'll get to after this. But, I mean, there's some incredible personalities you have to mix, but especially in one film. As a director, how do you guys approach directing actors? And does it change between movies? What's your experience there?
I would just jump in and then I'll
get it.
My first day, I'm a 20-something, had never directed anything longer than 30. Well, I had done some documentaries, but as far as drama, I'd never directed anything longer than 30 seconds. And I walk on the set my first day on Deathline, and there is Donald Pleasance and Norman Rossington staring at me and saying, "Okay, boss, what do you want to do?" And I got to tell you, these are combined. Those two guys had been in more films than I had ever seen. Right? I mean, it was really intimidating, and they weren't going to make it easy for me. The first couple of days, they just tested me, and I guess by day two or three, I passed. So we got, but working with Don, I learned more about directing actors from working with Donald Pleasance. I mean, he was my professor, and it was just an honor to, you know, this guy had Tonys, and I mean, he'd won every kind of award possible. He'd worked with all the great directors, and I was having the privilege of having him in front of my camera, and it really was a privilege.
No, he was one of the great. I'm so sorry he left us too early, but one of the great theatrical and cinematic actors of all time.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be in England in November. They're having a celebration of his 100th birthday, and they've asked me to come and speak. So I'm really excited about that.
Do you find you have to, are you the kinds of directors who like to get in the weeds with the actors, or like over direct, or do you try to like let them do their own thing? They just want to see you have vision?
One thing I wanted, dare I say, advice that I could give all you filmmakers out there. Two things. One, absolutely make sure you're making the same movie. And that goes for your crew too. You all have to be, if you all are marching to make the same movie, there's a chance, a much better chance that you will achieve that goal, or at least partially achieve that goal. But the main thing, actors, I mean, they the one thing I hate now, and this is the old guy get off my lawn speech, but
we usually reserve that for Galuzzo.
Yeah. That's
is guys and girls, everyone, filmmakers, don't sit by the monitor.
Yeah.
Sit by. You are the most thing to remember. You are the first audience for the movie. Get by the camera. Get close to your actors. Be there for them, right there. Have a little monitor like this, but don't sit there with your headphones on, 80 yards away in the video village. Be right there by the camera. Be right there. You are that. They will feed off your energy. You will feed off theirs. They are your movie. And Gary Sherman is a visual stylist. He's an incredible visual director, but also he's an actor's director. And I like to think I'm an actor's director as well. I don't know what the term means, really, because you're doing every director is an actor's director, I hope. But the thing to remember is you are the first audience for the actors. They're performing, in a sense, they're performing for you. And be there for them, and as close as you can get, it really does make a difference, I think, energy-wise and everything. Because I think I just hate to see, you know, the director cocooned in Video Village, and you know, and it's like, all right, do it again, yeah, let's go another take, do it again. And that's the only feedback the actors get, you know? I mean, you've got to... It's a really organic process, and you got to really a give and take for all the, and it doesn't matter how they work. It's your job to find out how they work. Yeah. Every actor works in a different way. There's different training. There's no training. There's intuitive acting. There's trained acting. There's a million different kinds of things, and it's your job to kind of figure out the best approach for each one. It could be. Multiple approaches. It will be multiple approaches for each actor.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with more with everything that Jeff just said. Again, I'll go back to the script. And when he said we have to make the same movie, it's the script. And some directors do. I never deviate a word from the script. I've worked on that script. I've worked with the writer. If somebody else wrote it, most of my scripts I wrote, and I just work with the actors and get them to understand the words. And you know, I think, I mean, Daniel Travanti, when I was doing Missing Persons, I'm still friends with Daniel, and he just said to me the other day, he said, "One thing I'll always remember is when you came up to me and said, 'I love the way you speak my words.'" And, you know, and that's what it's all about. It's about getting the, you know, working with the actors and turning, helping them become the character that you created in the script. And it's just great. And there are different ways that you work with different actors. And, working with Donald was...
Let me ask you, did you ever have formal rehearsal for any of your movies? Not a table read necessarily, but like a formal rehearsal.
Yes, I have done formal rehearsals. I like to rehearse. On Deathline, we really didn't have a chance to. How I work is I bring my whole cast and crew for each scene onto the floor. We rehearse the scene on the floor just for marks. Then I turn the set over to the crew, you know, to light and get everything set and set the camera and boom. And I go with the actor to makeup. And we work in makeup. And we do
Save
all
time.
Our rehearsals in the makeup room and then go back. On Vice Squad, working with Wings, I hope you're all going to come to Vice Squad this afternoon. We're going to have a great time.
And no one's ever seen it look great, right? This will be the first screening.
This will be the first screening where it really looks good. And actually, it's going to look even better soon. This was an early scan that we're going to see this afternoon. The 4K didn't make it here.
Okay.
And that's coming out from Scream Factory.
That's
shortly.
Coming out from, Shout.
Shout, thank you.
Shout. Yeah. And, but Wings, Wings, before Wings was Ramrod, he was Greg Foster in The Young and the Restless, the nicest man in the world. And in fact, when I said to the studio, "I want Wings Hauser to play Ramrod," they said, "Are you out of your fucking mind?" I said, "He's Greg Foster." And I said, "No, inside that person lives a lot of anger." Because I knew Wings. Wings was married to Nancy Locke, who was the mom with the little boy in the haunted house in Dead and Buried. So Wings was in Mendocino with us for quite a while we were shooting up there. And Wings and I got to be friends because he plays guitar and sings and I play guitar and sing, and so we used to play together, and we got drunk a lot. I did drink back then and too much. And I found out what was living inside of him. And so he and I play acted Ramrod quite a bit. And when the studio said no, so Bob Remy was the president of Avco Embassy at the time, and Frank Capra Jr. was the next in line, and they're saying to me, "Oh, we can't have Wings Hauser." I said, "No, I want Wings Hauser. He can do it." So they said, I'll bring him in, I'll read for you. And we rehearsed the scene, And the scene was, they were all at a table like this, all the executives at AFCO, and I brought Wings in, and Wings walks right into the room and has this look on his face and walks right to Bob Remy, right up to him, grabs him by the tie. This is the guy that's the president of the Academy, aside from the president of the studio. Grabs him by the tie, pulls him halfway across the table, and he says, "Are you the motherfucker that thinks I can't play this part?" And Raimi just goes, "Okay." And it was not a mistake, because
that's my favorite casting story of all time. Because it also could be a career ender. That's what's amazing about it. You have to risk something right there, right? But then you bring up an interesting point of, like, you had to see something. That'd be hard for other people to see that in him. You needed to know him. You needed to see that he had these demons that could come out. And that kind of just goes to, like, when you're casting as well, it's, are you trying to meet the person before, kind of in an interview style, get to see what's beyond that?
Well, to me, that English used to do that. I don't know if they still do, but the casting session is not about can you act. It's to see a final performance in the room. It's to see your style of working, your mindset, and how you view the character, etc. I think in many ways, in casting, a long talk with an actor can be more valuable than having them read a scene. Especially with an actor that's got some experience, so to have an actor read four lines, you know, in the room, it's crazy. And the other thing for all directors, I mean, just don't expect to see, or don't have in your mind to see, a final performance in the room. I mean, that's crazy. You're looking for a spark. You're looking for an intelligence. You're looking for a point of view, but you're not looking for a final performance.
Yeah, reading is a reading. I mean, this may come as a big surprise to a lot of directors, but actors are actually human beings, and you got to get to know that human being, and you work with that human being, and you bring stuff out from inside that person.
And the other thing in casting, like Gary said, the script is everything. Then the next step of that everything is the casting. And casting is something that if you miscast something, you can't fix it in post, other than scrapping the movie. I mean, you just can't. Yeah. So the style of the actor, the style of the human being, you've got to really see if you can work with them, or if there's that kind of synchronicity in a way. And the other thing is, don't have a set. So many directors, or so many writers that are directors, have a fixed idea, maybe on a physical level or just a verbal level, of what the character is. You will be shocked when if you take enough time in casting to know, oh, my initial conception, out the window. This is so much cooler, whatever. It's not to say you always abandon your initial conception, but don't be locked in. It's a fluid process, as filmmaking is. It's a fluid process. It's never locked in until the final cut. And then even when you do the final cut, you might have Sam Markoff doing another final cut. So it's never locked in. So you always have to have the open mind, the fluidity, but also keeping in mind what excited you about the movie to begin with, and that's really your spine that you keep.
It's a true collaboration.
Yeah,
it is. It is. Everybody there on the set is part of the film. I mean, as a director, you help make the movie, but you need the interaction between the actors and the director, the interaction between the crew and the actors and the director. I mean, one of your most important people on any movie is your head makeup person, because they're the one that gets your actors every morning and first, and if they put the actor in a good mood, it helps you a lot.
Yeah.
So it's like when we were doing Deathline, I got Harry Frampton, who was like a legendary makeup person. Harry says to me, "How long's this movie? How long are you going to be shooting?" I said, "Oh, we're going to do this in 3 weeks." And we worked a 7-day week. We shot the picture in 20 days. And because nobody was available. And Harry said, "Oh, that's great." He said, "Because I definitely have 3 weeks worth of material." Because he basically did stand up every morning.
Oh, wow.
You know?
That's cool.
He was great. He was so funny. He just had everybody in stitches. You know, and there's Hugh, who has to come in every morning and go through 2 hours of makeup. And, you know, but he just got everybody up and everybody ready for the day. And
that's great. That's a great tip. Yeah. I wouldn't have even thought of that.
Yeah.
That's
great. Before we delve into sequel talk, the two of you, you both have directed some pretty incredible horror icons. Jeff, I mean, getting Vincent Price for your first movie, which is incredible.
It was an honor for me to work with Vincent.
Literally went to his house, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I think Darren told us that story. Like, you literally like drove to his house and asked him while he was like mowing his lawn.
Absolutely. That's how it all started. But it was... it's a different era back then. That would have been 1985.
Yeah, so don't do that now. It's called
totally
stalking.
Totally different era. The paranoia had not taken over America, but as most people have said about him, he was an incredibly gracious human being, an incredible graceful human being, and smart and so intelligent, so funny. Loved life, and he was genuinely amused that we came to his house, and he invited us in, and we it wasn't an elevator pitch for the project. It was sit down and let me know, and who are you guys? What are you? So it was like 20 minutes we were there. So Scream Factory documentary directed by Daniel Griffith will tell you it was a much more involved process to actually get him on the set. But once we had him on the set, it was he couldn't have been more professional, couldn't have been more encouraging, and delightful, quite honestly. It was a magical magical event for me to be able to direct Vincent Price, and he made me look better than I was. That's for sure.
Was there a film you geeked out with him about from his filmography?
Actually, the first thing I said to him, which was true, in a Chattanooga reference, I had seen him do a one-man show on Oscar Wilde called Diversions and Delights. At the Tivoli Theater in Chattanooga. And I was like in probably 1977. So that was the first thing I told him, and that at least that was, you know. I was a big Witchfinder General fan, and so he told me those stories. He's told a million times, I was just a huge fan of, and of course the Corman Poe movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I also, you know, I said, you know, the movies he did with Otto Preminger, and so I tried. We tried to, you know, tell him we were a little more than just, you know, we were cinephiles, not just horror cinephiles.
Yeah.
You know.
And Gary, your first film, I think it's the only movie that Donald Pleasence and Christopher Lee share screen time together, which blew me away when I read that fact. I was like, oh, wow, I just figured they must have worked together.
They would have done more.
But that's the only one. And so, I mean, you're intimidated by Donald Pleasence, but what's it like to have Christopher Lee come in?
Yeah, that voice.
Well, you know, when I said to – I wrote the part for Donald Pleasence. I mean, I had Donald Pleasence in my head when I wrote Inspector Cahoon. And everybody said to me, "You're nuts, you're nuts, you're not going to get him." And I said, "You know what? Everybody keeps telling me he wants to do a comedy."
Usually get a laugh at that point. But those parts are funny that he's in. All those
scenes are funny. I know. Yeah. And I mean, Donald's part was written completely for comedy, mm-hmm. even though it's in, you know, the middle of Deathline, which is not a comedy. And I knew that, you know... Anyways, Jay Cantor, you know, had been the agent who was now the executive producer of Deathline, and knew every agent knew Jay. And so Donald's agent actually took it seriously when we sent the script, because it had Jay Cantor's name on it. And she gave it to Donald, and Donald read it and said, "You know what? I love this part, and I want to meet the director." So he was doing Man in the Glass Booth on Broadway, so I flew to New York and went to the show and had dinner with him afterwards, and he and I got on like crazy, and he did it. Now I get back to London, and Paul Maslansky, who's producing Deathline, is best friends with Christopher Lee. He'd done a whole bunch of, you know, early Christopher Lee movies. And so Christopher's having dinner with Paul, and he says, I hear you're doing a movie in London. And he said, yeah. And he said, you haven't called me. And Paul said, you know what, Chris? You get more per movie than we have as a whole budget on this film. And he said, but you've got Donald Pleasance. And I said, yeah, well, that's where our budget went. And he said, if you give me a scene with Donald Pleasance and I don't have to wear my teeth, I will do it for scale.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
And that's how it happened. I wrote the scene. The scene didn't exist before. Stratton Villiers, the character that Chris plays, was an off-screen character. He was on the telephone a couple of times to Inspector Cahoon, but never on camera, so I wrote the scene. And then I realize Christopher Lee is like 7'9", and Donald Pleasance is like 4'3". How am I gonna...
White shot.
A lot of apple boxes.
They're never on camera together until Chris sits down, if you watch the scene.
Interesting.
I shot them both in singles, By shooting them in singles, I was able to adjust their height. And they both looked straight into camera. And I had, you know, the camera here for Kristen. I had the camera here for Donald. And what I did was, at the beginning of the scene, Donald's the powerful character. So it's like extreme close-up and it's extreme wide shot on Chris. And then every line, I got further away from Donald and closer to Chris. And then finally Chris sits down, and then I could do an over-the-shoulder from Donald so that you knew they were in the same room, because otherwise it would have looked like one was in London and one was in Los Angeles. But figuring that out, I suddenly realized that after, you know, I wrote this mano-a-mano scene for the two of them, that... there was about 2 foot difference in their height.
All right, Elric, I will let you take it away
I was curious. Since both of you guys have helmed sequels in various capacities, some of them completely off the rails from the original, how do you approach a sequel when you're brought into the project? How do you approach the source material and deciding what needs to be preserved or how much love you're going to give to it? And where do you even begin?
I mean, it's a the Gary did a fairly big budget sequel, but the movies I sequelized, almost all of them were low budget. So the challenge is often that you're given a lot less resources to somehow make it like the first movie in some way. The challenge of a sequel is not necessarily a creative challenge, but it's more dealing with the producers and the distributors who virtually want, if they could clone the movie and get someone to pay for it again, they would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to do a sequel, they want the old wine in a new bottle.
Do you find that they also want the more blood, more boobs, more guns?
No. I mean, sometimes yes, but for me, in my experience, they really want that old wine, the same wine, in just a slightly different new bottle. And
but wait, what does that mean for? Because you said smaller. You're trying to put Leatherface is one of the biggest franchises.
No, but Leatherface was a substantially smaller budget than number two.
But in terms of like, how do you capture the old wine with that after? After two.
Well, the problem,
so off the rails.
Well, the problem is, and you hear the word all the friggin' time, and you hear it in a lot more. I really respect filmmakers now because they have to put up with a lot more than I did when I was starting out. The word franchise, I cannot stand that word. in regard to movies or product or software or that crap.
IP.
IP. Exactly. That's even worse. That's even worse.
That's the buzzword now.
Yes, I know. That's even worse.
Intellectual property.
So it's tough. All they want is something so similar. So I'm the exact opposite. I'm going. You have something that is virtually assured, especially doing a direct-to-video sequel of a movie that, like I've done too many of. That's the time to experiment because you have something that's quote unquote guaranteed to have some audience. That's the time you go nuts and experiment, you know, because you have a basis, a template that is successful. So that was always a fight and argument that I always had. With the sequels that I did, but in regard to Chainsaw, there is no way to corporately duplicate the first movie, and I don't think that the executives really thought that through, because the first movie was done. I mean, completely not. If you have Screen Actors Guild involved or any variation of that, there's no way in hell that you can duplicate that first movie, because that first movie was a product of how it was made, when it was made, who made it, everything. It really was an alchemy of all those people together, and the heat of Texas and the location, the voodoo of location, et cetera.
Dead animal carcasses stinking up the joint.
Exactly.
Even just some of the violence of it alone, and how kind of visceral it is. Like, SAG would shut that down immediately.
You can't shoot. You cannot shoot 24 hours straight like they do in that dinner scene. You know, that kind of thing. So that's unduplicable. Replicatable in a real way, and not even in a creative way, just in a real way. So that's always, especially if it's an iconic first movie that you're dealing with. And here's the thing with Leatherface, and it's a very complex subject for me, but in Leatherface, it was doomed from the start in a way, because the first movie was so scary and so ahead of its time, so amazingly regional and everything. Here, the second movie was so funny and so outre and so wild that way, no matter what you did with the third movie, it's going to fall somewhere.
Dead center. But it's, what was the directive told you? Because I remember the infamous trailer, which is still one of the great crazy trailers. It definitely feels like they're trying to make, you know, Freddy, or make Leatherface a true icon.
That was the plan, I guess, internally when it was first developed, but then it became more and more the plan when Nightmare 5 opened and did not do the kind of business that all the rest of them had. It kind of, there was a drop off. Okay, we need a new franchise character to replace or bolster Freddy. So that's kind of Leatherface was, and it wasn't written to be. It wasn't like to do that. Then you have, it would be a movie about Leatherface if you really wanted to have him be that key franchise character, because the Chainsaw movies were not just about Leatherface, they were about the families, you know, and the third one was as well.
Is that what you're trying to say? Because I imagine with doing sequels, you also want to slip in some of yourself, the things that excite you.
No, here's the thing. With doing a sequel, invariably, I mean, you cannot escape. You are building a wing or you're redoing something on someone else's foundation. So if the house is built, then you're tearing down part of the house to build another part of the house that's more you, or whatever analogy you want, but you're always on someone's foundation, and this foundation could be a little sandy and not so good in the Puppet Master situation, or it can be rock solid like Leatherface.
Well, what was it in Leatherface for you? Because I know when I watched it with Rob not long ago, always liked the movie a lot, but loved it when we got to see the uncensored, the version that had some of the effects put back in.
There was never really an uncensored version of that movie, because it would happen now, but it just, there, it was obviously pre-digital, so literally the time was so tight in editorial, in post-production, that we were cutting the negative as we were going, reel by reel. And because we had to make a release date, and so when the MPAA kept, we went back 12 times. It was a record at the time. I don't know if it still is, but every time we went to the MPAA, then the shots would get shorter and shorter, but negative cut shorter. They never did a protective IP. Yeah. So video dailies, I think, but that's the only thing that exists. But that was just a function of the time and the mood, and so it was not. I think it was just attacked because New Line had a tradition of horror films, and Canon had put out the second Chainsaw movie as an unrated movie. And I think the MPAA took that as an FU, and so they really were gunning, because it wasn't. I mean, now CSI shows has. I mean, you can see on television what even the hardest version of Leatherface ever was.
But that wasn't what impressed me. Was honestly, it was family dynamics. It was like the movies, you see this interesting family function and how each relationship goes to the next, and just the little girl and the mother, you know, clues.
No, that's really good stuff. A director. That's the stuff that excited me the most. Yeah, absolutely, and building that family was that was the most successful maybe part of the movie.
The other one, so he has Ramrod and Wings. You get, in my opinion, Terry O'Quinn in Stepfather 2.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
That goes off.
Well, Terry O'Quinn, that's a case where it was a British company called ITC. They wanted to do lower budget sequels to their successful library titles. So this was the first one they did. And they did not realize, to an extent, they didn't realize how important it was to get Terry O'Quinn back. Oh, yeah. And I go, guys, you can't make it without him. You know, I
mean, go watch part three. Part three proves your point.
Well, and that wasn't the director's fault, because Terry just did not want to do it. But that was my first professional movie, because The Offspring was a completely independent movie. We raised money, made it, and it came out. And my brother and Darren Scott were the producers. And now on Stepfather 2, we were hired by a company to make this movie. So it was a completely different, it was a very huge learning curve for me in terms of you have to, one thing, if you ever make a movie that you don't control, let's say, the so-called director for hire, which I hate that term too, but a director for hire, you basically have to justify every fucking creative decision to an executive branch. Either the head of the company or the executive in charge of production, whatever. There's always going to be one guy or two guys or three guys that create fires so they can look like heroes when they put them out. And that happens, in mainstream filmmaking, that happens constantly. And that's just a huge hassle, which has nothing to do with the making of the movie. But anyway, but that was the first movie where I went through that process. But my fear on that movie, to make a long story short, my fear on that movie was Terry O'Quinn. When we did get him, he's the 800-pound gorilla. I'm an unknown director directing this low-budget thing of a successful movie he did, his most successful role to date at that time. And here I am. He's the 800-pound gorilla, and I go, "Oh man, if he's he could make my life miserable." Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely the exact opposite. Oh, he was a prince, and just a incredibly collaborative, incredibly supportive, and it was just a joy to work with him every day. I mean, truly.
Yeah, that's one of the great genre performances in part one, right? So to carry that character over.
Exactly. It's iconic.
And your wedding scene's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh. It's one of the craziest scenes.
It is.
If you guys haven't seen part two, you've got to see that scene. Great stuff.
But anyway, and Synapse put out a special version of that on DVD. It's not on Blu-ray, but on DVD years back. If you're mildly interested, check it out.
And Gary, we know you're going to be doing your own presentation here on the last day about some of the, you know, the true magic that I think cinematic in-camera magic of Poltergeist 3. But what's fun about this episode, and only people who really have listened for years can authenticate us, like you get a lot of people who have to do shows like this and they have to go, "Oh, I love all your movies." But like we've been talking about, the three of us have loved Poltergeist 3 since we started doing this 6 years ago. We've loved, Leatherface is a movie that's come up multiple times. So I feel like we're allowed to get into the weeds on this a little bit. But for me, I always thought part three was like the scariest to me. I don't know if it was just, I think it is how the effects are rendered. I think there's something about Kane in this film that it's just unnerving. Like, and maybe it's the setting. I don't know.
To me, it always felt like it blew up the world a bit, because in the first two, they were ultimately kind of house horrors. I mean, we may get to a cave suburbia for a little bit, but it was like a haunted house tale. This one, there's a whole city inside of a building and some weird shit going on with all the windows and the inner workings of the building. Like, it really did feel like it blew up the world a little bit. So how did you even kind of get them to go with this?
Well, you know, Jay Cantor and Alan Ladd Jr., who had been my producers on Deathline and gave me my first chance to make a movie, were now running MGM. And, you know, Laddie was the chairman and Jay was the president. And they came to me and asked me to do Poltergeist 3. They had a problem. They needed to get it done. They wanted to do it. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was Poltergeist 3.
Had you even seen the second one? Or
I'd seen it. I was offered the second one and I turned it down. And I had seen the first one, which, you know, was Spielberg and Toby Hooper. Yeah. And I mean, and just was wowed by it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great, great film. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I had also been offered at one time to remake Touch of Evil.
Oh, wow.
And I said, there is no way. There is no way. I mean, I'm not going to remake Orson Welles. Why remake Orson Welles? The film is brilliant. And so I, you know, I said, I really don't want to do it. And they said, oh, no, we want you to do it, and please do it. And I said, I thought about it, and I said, you know what? I had developed a film with Jay and Laddie in London right after we did Deathline that took place in the John Hancock Building, because I love the John Hancock Building. It's one of the most amazing places. It is an entire city. I mean, it's a city that 100,000 people pass through every day. And it's a building, you know, and it's got everything. I mean, I know people who live in the Hancock Building and never leave. Their office is in the Hancock Building. They do their grocery shopping. They do their clothes shopping. They do, you know, you can buy everything. You park your car. You never need to leave the building. There's no reason. And so I always wanted to do something. So I said to them, okay, I'll tell you what. If you want me to do a sequel, Poltergeist, there's two conditions. Number one, I'm going to do it in Chicago in the John Hancock Building. I want to create the world's largest haunted house.
Yeah.
Cool. And number two, I want to do all the effects practical.
Yes.
Yes.
So badass.
No opticals. No CGI.
So wild.
No, nothing. Everything is first generation negative in the camera. Back then we had to shoot film. We didn't, digital didn't even exist. Laddie looks at me and says, are you crazy? I said, you know that already. And he says, you know how to do this? And I said, yeah, because I began my career on an optical printer and an animation stand. That's the first thing that I did. And so I said, you know, if you can do it with an Oxberry, which was the kind of these huge machines with multiple projectors and multiple lenses, and you put it all into one lens and create composites, and when you were doing opticals, I said, there's no reason I can't do that on the set. I know how to do it in a lab, so I think I can do it on a set. I know I can do it on a set. And that's what I set out to do. So It was a fun experience until Heather died.
Did you also know that the parents wouldn't be involved before you starting to conceptualize the film? That the story would be she was sent to other relatives?
Well, the as we got into it, and the studio said to me the parents wanted $1 billion to come back and do number three. And they said, if you can get around that, figure out how to get around it. So Craig Nelson and Joe Beth Williams were left in the dust.
For yuppie Tom Skerritt.
And Tom Skerritt was a huge star. Yeah, I mean, he'd just done, you know...
Alien and many more.
Alien and Top Gun.
Oh, yeah.
So,
did you feel any allegiance to Toby Hooper or Brian Gibson in your conception or in your... Did that ever enter your head?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Toby and Steven you know, what they did on the first one. Brian's a friend, was a friend. Brian has passed away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I was really happy when Brian got the second one, but I wasn't really happy with what he did on the second one. I think that he really let Stephen and Toby down in Poltergeist 2. I just don't think it was a great movie. And I just wanted to go in a completely different direction. I was only two thoughts in my mind going into Poltergeist 3, and that was my favorite characters. It was all about characters. And it was Carol Ann, which we say 9,000 times.
Carol Ann!
Zelda. Carol Ann! Carol Ann!
And Tangina.
Yeah.
And Zelda didn't want to do it. She didn't want to do a third one, and I talked her into doing it. I met with her, and she and I just really got on, and I said, I really want to get into who Tangina is as a human being and really, you know, expand the character, and the same with Carol Ann. And I had met with Heather, and I knew that Heather had the chops to really act. Mm. She was unbelievable. I mean, I miss her. She would have grown up to be an incredible asset to our industry. Hmm. And she wanted to direct, and which was really her goal. She wanted to stop acting and go to school and learn to be a director. Hmm. And I think she would have been a great director. She's incredibly intelligent. And
how much did you have to... So with the gags being such a key part of this film, like each effect sequence is just so key to, you know, how you experience the terror of the film. How much of that did you have to write knowing what you could pull off, or did you write letting your imagination go wild and then try to solve the problem?
I let my imagination run away with me, and then I was gonna, and it became a challenge to me to figure out how to shoot it.
Interesting.
Like, I remember I was over at a friend's house. Who was a writer? She was a writer then, and we had worked together on a couple of things. And I said, you know, I have this idea, and I said, pretend that this is a mirror, and put your hands on the mirror. And she put her hands up on the mirror, and I grabbed her hands, and she like jumped back and screamed.
And you're like, it works.
I said, that's what I'm going to do. The fingers are going to come through the mirror and grab her hands. And she said, how are you going to do that? And I said, I'll figure it out. and you know, that's how we approached everything. And I mean, in this room tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to tell all you guys how we did that. It was great. I had a ball.
We obviously won't get all your secrets on air, but what was the most difficult sequence to pull off visually with in camera effects?
The cup through the mirror. Hmm. That was really, really, really complicated. Oh, you know what? I'll talk about a simpler one because that one take me a long time. But Carol Ann, we go from a close-up of Carol Ann on the bed, and she gets up and walks to the window, and then the camera is outside the window, and you see the reflection of the skyline in the window. And everybody's always asking me how we did that one. In fact, Edgar Wright is in London right now doing a movie called Last Night in Soho, and he's got some mirror effects in it, and he called me last week and he said, how did you do that shot, Carol Ann? And I told him.
I remember reading a teen magazine, and this is when it came out. I was reading, like, and they had this big interview with Heather, and in it, this was like a teen, like, 10-year-old girl magazine, they detailed how the puddle scene was done in the parking garage and with the tank underneath, and you actually had a guy in it.
Oh, yeah. That was, you know, I'll talk about that one tomorrow, too. That one was pretty easy, but figuring out how to get the camera outside.
Yeah.
And basically what it is, and because this is pretty easy to visualize, if you think about the way that the set looked with window, and heavy iron, you know, or steel in between the windows, we actually took out one of the windows and attached the window to the dolly. And as we were shooting through the window, we got black cloth around. And, you know, we had so many mirrors and windows and glass there. The entire crew, we had to wear black jumpsuits and black masks.
Now, how many feet up were you? Or were you actually, like, on a studio?
No, this was a studio. Rebuilt three floors. We built three floors. I had so much fun. It was like, you know. I remember walking onto the set. We had 200,000 square feet of sets on Poltergeist 3.
Wow.
And I remember walking into the set, seeing three stories of the Hancock building being built on the set. And I thought, and all I could think about was sitting down with a yellow pad and writing this scene. And now it was getting built. It's like a dream machine. I mean, it was so exciting that there's all these people working and all these people employed and you know, and building three stories of the John Hancock building on a soundstage. And it was thrilling. So, and I, you know, obviously, you know, we knew I had to design all the effects before we started building the sets. So there was a floor below and a floor above. And they were in the middle floor because a lot of the effects we needed to be a floor above. And so there was a triple set. And everything was a double set because there were mirrors and then there weren't mirrors. So every set that was built as a mirror image. And we could put the real mirrors in or we would not have mirrors. And so now on this shot, Heather getting up, I have the camera right in front of her. Well, it would be reflected in the mirror. So it was a double set behind, and there was a double, and we had a metronome on the set and a choreographer that worked with the actor and the doubles. And it would all be on like a click track. So everybody knew what their movements were. And we would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse the movements as if we were doing a dance number. Yep. We really were shooting a musical without music. And, you know, the metronome was the music and doo-doop. And so there was Heather and then Heather's double in the background. So when Heather puts down the speak and spell and gets up, the double does the same thing and it's all to the... It's playing on the set. And Heather comes walking up to the window, and the window is moving away from her as she's walking to it. And then as we get to the wall, to the outside, it locks, the window locked in hydraulically. And there's four grips on the floor who fall behind. That's why we put that window seat at the edge so that, you know, when we were doing these shots, the grips and would have a place to hide. So, you know, there's four grips moving the camera with this huge window with little, you know, black aluminum frame around it. And it locked in. The camera continues out and then turns slightly so that we get the reflection of the translights. And we had translights. Well, this is a good room because the translights were about the size of that wall, the back wall there, and except probably 50-70% longer. I mean, these translights, do you know what translights are? Because the translights are like transparencies, they're photographs, and ours were animated as well. The lights blinked in and off and lights would go out so that it always looked like you had a live shot out there, and we had some airplanes going through the sky and things like that.
How much prep did you have with that movie?
About a year.
Oh, nice.
You're like, man.
Yeah. And I, you know, while I was prepping the movie, I shot two pilots. So it was a busy time. Too busy. I wish I had been able to concentrate more on. I mean, I love what we did with the effects. The movie has its shortcomings for me, and then the fact that I wrote an ending for that film, the original script, that the studio just said to me, there is no way, because it was going to take almost as long to shoot the ending as it took to shoot the rest of the movie.
Oh, wow.
And the effects were just incredible. And Dick Smith, you know, who was just amazing. I mean, I got to work with Dick Smith, yeah. who mentored Stan Winston and got to work with Stan Winston and Rick Baker. I mean, working with these people was just such a gift. It was a blessing to be able to work with people who were that talented. And Dick Smith loved what we were going to do. We were actually going to do a physical morph, turning Tangina into Carol Ann and Carol Ann into Tangina. Hmm. And it was a matter of going back and forth between the two of them and, you know, building, taking Tangina away from Carol Ann and which was mainly going to be Heather, because it'd be harder to turn Tangina into Carol Ann than Carol Ann into Tangina. So when Tangina turned into Carol Ann, it was going to be mostly Heather and vice versa. But it was really going to be very, very complicated, and the whole effect of them passing through the mirror and turning into each other. And we were going to need more special effects people than existed in Chicago. we were shooting in Chicago. I wanted to shoot it in Chicago at the actual John Hancock Building as much as possible. And it just was better because we're going back and forth between the real Hancock Building and the sets. So it would have been in the way that we were shooting. And also, the Hancock Building didn't want us there every day. I mean, this is a building with, you know, $1 million and up condominiums, and those people don't really want a film crew in their building. But we talked them into it. So, it was quite an experience.
Has it taken you a long time to kind of come back to appreciate the work you did on the film? Did you have to have a long gap from thinking about that film, I seen?
You know what? In the last few years, I mean, I had gotten away from Poltergeist, sir. I wouldn't do interviews about it or anything because of Heather. As I said, I really loved that little girl. I mean, my girlfriend and I at the time, if we could have adopted her, we would have. I mean, we used to borrow her from her parents all the time and just take her out and go to the zoo and, you know, whatever. I wanted her to. I wanted to adopt her, and so God, I lost.
Well, I mean, you obviously had to come back to finish the movie; otherwise, the studio would finish it. So I figured that must be a sore spot.
Yeah, it was really a sore spot because after she died, Jay and Laddie, I flew back to Los Angeles. I was actually shooting a television series in Chicago. We had shot the pilot in Chicago because I was there prepping Poltergeist 3. We were supposed to shoot in New York, and I talked the network into shooting in Chicago. So we shot it, and they loved it in Chicago. So we were doing the series in Chicago. And we were getting set to do the ending because we shot an ending on the picture that I hated, that the studio hated, that everybody hated. And this cheap ending that we had done that was pretty bad, and so I talked them into doing the real ending, and we were going to shoot it in LA and because there weren't enough special effects people in Chicago. And Dick Smith, it took him about 4 months to build all the prosthetics for the scene, and he was doing it, and we were when I got a call from David Wardlow, who was Heather's agent, and said, I need to have a conference call with you in the studio this afternoon. And that conference call was him telling us that Heather had died that morning. Oh, man. And
is that coming from no knowledge that she was sick for you? Or?
She wasn't sick. She got sick that morning. I mean, she had a congenital problem that they never went undiagnosed, so nobody knew that she was sick.
Yeah.
I mean, she was having some problems, but they thought she had Lyme's disease or something, and she didn't. Anyhow, so I flew to Los Angeles, and Jay and Laddie and I sat down in a room with Dick Berger and Barry Bernardi, and we all sat down together and said, what are we going to do? And I said, not finish the film. And Laddie went, yes, okay, I don't want to finish a film and release a film with a dead 11-year-old in it either. And so at that point, and the next day was Heather's funeral, which we were, you know, all part of. I was a pallbearer at her funeral. And I get emotional talking about it. Yeah, anyways, I went back to my television series, Sable, and they called me and they said, the board of directors said, either you finish the movie or we'll finish the movie. And Jay and Laddie and I talked and said, okay, let's finish the movie. So I wrote that awful scene that finishes the movie now and had a double for Heather, which was really hard on all of us. And we just shot, you know, from the time that Nancy breaks through the window off the window washing rig, which that we had all shot, and that was all shot in Chicago. But when she hits the floor inside, from that point to the end was all new footage that we shot in Los Angeles a couple of months after Heather died and finished the movie. And
I mean, that just sounds like an impossible job. I mean, especially even just having to face all these actors who had just lost somebody.
Like Scott, the kid that played Scott, Kip Wentz, was at Harvard or Yale, I don't remember which Ivy League school he was going to, and he was in the middle of midterms or finals or something, and said, I can't leave. I said, oh, to hell with it. We won't bring you back. So that's why he's not in the end scene.
Disappears into the She rips his face off and he's gone.
He's gone. He just stayed on the other side. Nobody cared. I didn't care.
Just get it done, right?
And I just wanted to get through it and get it done and finish the film and let them release it. Neither Tom, Nancy, Zelda, or I, or Laura Flynn Boyle did any publicity for the picture. None of us would do it. We all said we are not going out there because all they're going to ask us about is Heather. Yeah. And I moved. I changed my phone number because I was being followed by the National Enquirer and you know, publications of that ilk for months afterwards. They all wanted, you know, me to do interviews about Heather, and I refused to do it. And until E! Channel came to me years later and said, we want to do a tribute to Heather, and we'd like you to do it, and you can have final cut. So yeah. I said, okay. And that's when I did that True Hollywood Stories, the Curse of Poltergeist. And I just did another one for Shudder, which also they promised me the same thing. But anyhow.
Well, it's also nice that people get to see her work. Because she does great work.
I mean, I know it was a very tough thing for you to do, but to finish the film, at least to whatever degree you could, just as a tribute to her work. To not have the movie come out, I think, would have been the wrong decision.
Right, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know what I mean? I mean, just in terms of tribute to her. I mean,
you know, just to answer your question, which I went around in a very long-winded way. In the last few years, practical effects have become the thing. Horror fans want practical effects. Science fiction fans like CGI. But horror fans, you guys, my audience, I love you. And I love horror. And horror should happen in front of your face. And so this whole thing of people wanting to do practical effects, everybody started calling and talking to me about Poltergeist 3. And I've always said in interviews over all the years that the only thing that I'm really proud of in Poltergeist 3 are the effects. And now I'm getting a chance to talk about it. And I'm, you know, the Rue Morgue magazine called me last year and said, would I come up to Toronto and do a lecture and maybe talk about the practical effects of Poltergeist 3? So I put that lecture together, and I've been doing that lecture over and over, and now I'm actually doing a book.
That's great.
So I'm going to publish a book about the effects of Poltergeist 3.
Well, it seems you need visuals to help with some of this because it's so complicated, you know? So
well, I've got all the visuals are going to
be for tomorrow. Here. That's why people can't miss it.
You know, the script was about this thick of Poltergeist.
He's holding a foot up if you're at home listening.
Oh, that's giant right. Foot. We're on radio. Yeah.
It could be 3 meters. Could be a foot. No one knows.
It's like that. Country about that makes me remind of the Stan Freeberg commercials for radio back in the 60s. Where 50s actually. Yeah, those were unbelievable.
TV stuff.
He said, he'd say, okay, bring on 4,000 pounds of ice cream and 3,000 pounds of hot fudge and a big maraschino cherry. He said, do that on television. You know, which today with digital we could. But the script was about like 6-8 inches thick because it has all the storyboards and nobody understood. In fact, the gaffer on Poltergeist 3 and I are still friends, and he came to a presentation I did on this thing, and he said, I just want you to know, we had our first production meeting on Poltergeist 3 went 17 hours. And nobody understood anything when they walked out after 17 hours. So I put the script together, and there was actually somebody on the movie whose job it was to carry the script around. And we had this stand built that
to worship
before every scene, everybody, and I had all these fold outs, they folded out forever. Everything was storyboarded. There were overheads, there were mechanical drawings of how the refraction and refraction and reflections worked. So that everybody would know how exact the camera position had to be. I mean, we couldn't be off by a half a degree in terms of the setup of where the set was, where the mirrors were. Because, you know, every time we were using multiple mirrors. And so every time you add a mirror, it doubles the movement. I got to tell you, George Kohut, who was the camera operator on Poltergeist 3, operating a camera with a 45-degree mirror mounted at the front of the camera, so he's looking this way, and we're shooting Jeff, and he's got to operate those wheels, and because there's a mirror there, the movement is doubled. So he's having to move at like half speed of what he would normally, his whole career, moving that camera. And we were shooting on Panaflex Platinum. I mean, which was, you know, about the size of this table. Those were big. You were talking about a BNC. You ever try a handhold one? I mean, you know, it was...
Save some of the secrets so these guys come back tomorrow.
Oh,
I need you to save... one name that you did mention, which does segue nicely, is Stan Winston, you just mentioned.
Yeah, Stan.
And taking over Pumpkinhead, Jeff, what direction? Because you went in a very different direction.
Well, here's the thing. That was a case of kind of replacing a director in pre-production.
Oh.
Tony Randall, he was the original director.
Hellraiser.
And I guess he developed the script, but really what happened, and this is unbeknownst to me at the time, that Brad Trevoy, a legendary seat of your pants producer, basically met somebody at a party or something, and that person told him, well, the rights to Pumpkinhead are available at this bank auction, this bankruptcy auction of DEG assets, De Laurentiis company. And so he goes, oh, really? So he bid for the rights. He got the rights. But the caveat was he had to start shooting to retain the rights or whatever. He had to start shooting a movie that's kind of similar to the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. Mm-hmm. He had to shoot the movie at a certain point, or he lost the rights. So what he did was he was developing an existing script about some killer or something. Hey, make the killer, make it Pumpkinhead instead of a serial killer, make it Pumpkinhead. And so, you know, a little cut and paste, and there it was, you know. So the script was in hideous shape. And it was like a very very shortened pre-production I had because I replaced this other director. So maybe 3 weeks, two and a half weeks of prep, and a few sets had been built and whatever. So you were inheriting a situation that you knew was iffy. Iffy. And just very coincidentally, the production designer on my first movie, it was the first movie she ever did, was the production designer on Pumpkinhead, the original Pumpkinhead. So I was kind of aware of Pumpkinhead, and Boy Ann Bazzelli, I'd met several times the DP of it. And I go, okay, I really want to contact Stan Winston. You might not want to do that, Jeff. Stan. Word on the street is he's really pissed off this is happening. So I never met him until many years later. I was at the Sitges, it was 2003, I think. I was at the Sitges Film Festival in Spain. And I think Stan Winston was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award later in the festival or whatever. And so I go into the bar in the hotel. There's Stan Winston. It's just he and I kind of right there. And very few other people in the bar. So I got to go up. I got to meet him. So I go up and I introduce myself stupidly as, hey, Mr. Winston, I'm a big fan of yours. Matter of fact, my name is Jeff Burr, and I directed Pumpkinhead 2. He looked at me like, you motherfucker. did not say a word. Didn't say a word. Just looked at me with that, you can imagine the look, and left.
Oh my gosh, was it heartbreaking?
it was like, you know, well, you know, let me get a bourbon and contemplate, you know, what just happened. So anyway, so that's my Stan Winston.
Oh damn.
Oh man.
I was hoping there's a twist.
Yeah, it was like, and then he came back.
There wasn't like, oh, the next day, you know, oh, I'm sorry, I was jet lagged. No, yeah, that was my Stan Winston. Oh.
I'm still
a fan of the work.
Yeah, of course. Wow.
But I'll say that the Pumpkinhead, the original Pumpkinhead, the look of it and the actual creature, amazing.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful job, and primarily done by Alec Gillis and
Tom Woodruff.
Yeah, exactly. And Boy Ann Bazzelli did a great job. So the Pumpkinhead I did was a... It was one of those things where you go, okay, what can I do with it, what you're handed? The bad decision, good decision, whatever, was you got to have fun with it because this ain't working any other way. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, okay, make a kind of 50s inspired monster on the loose, man in a suit movie, mm-hmm. you know, and so for better or worse. And it's I've taken a lot of slings and arrows on that movie.
I like that movie. I think it's a good
but some, I think with sequels, though, it's all about expectation. Mm. And if you're expecting the same movie or somewhat similar to the same movie as the first movie, you're going to be hideously disappointed. You know?
Right. I hope you don't mind me telling this, but I got the Blu-ray, the Scream Factor one.
Oh,
but
yeah,
I can't get rid of my DVD because one of the first times I met Jeff, I gave him the Pumpkinhead DVD too. And he wrote on it, "Dear Rob, thanks for being the one fan of this movie." So I still proudly own that.
All right.
And I'm sure I'm not the only fan.
Yeah.
For both of you guys, I mean, Jeff, I bumped into you at Chattanooga last year, so you come to this festival. How much do you guys still keep up with what's going on in the horror genre, and what as of late has kind of excited you cinematically, like in this world? Because again, I think the fun about horror is this is the genre where people take chances and do interesting things with not a lot of money. So do you still keep
up with that stuff? That's very true. And horror is probably the only genre where having lack of some limited resources and unknown people can be very helpful, as opposed to a romantic comedy or something or whatever. But I still love horror films. I love film in general. For me, I went through a period, and this is my fault, not the creator's fault. I went through a period where I just mourned the death of film. I mean, truly, it was like a death. And it was like the death of celluloid. And even though it's maybe on life support, it's not dead, but and so I really didn't see that much for a fairly, you know, couple of years, 3 years, and it was just, and then there was just a kind of an onslaught of stuff. There's just so much stuff out there, and for good and bad. So the one film I saw relatively recently that I would have, it almost took a gun in my head for me to see it, because it was a sequel or a reboot or whatever. And I go, this can't be good, even though I like the director. The Halloween remake or reboot or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I was very impressed with that. And I thought it would be completely the other way around. And I was very, very impressed with that.
Yeah, I watch a lot of films, and I love meeting and talking with young filmmakers and seeing, you know, bringing innovation into the thing. And, you know, again, with Jeff, digital production has democratized filmmaking to a great extent. In some ways, maybe too democratized, because, I mean, just because you have a digital camera doesn't mean you know how to shoot. And just because you have Final Cut or Adobe Premiere doesn't mean that you know how to cut a film, and just because you have Scripter doesn't mean you know how to write a movie. But there's a lot of really great filmmakers and young filmmakers that are coming through it. I've been a judge at so many film festivals over the last few years, and I really love it because it gives me a chance. I mean, I come to festivals, I watch as many films as I can at festivals, and then I go back to my room and I have hard drives full of films from other festivals that I'm about to go to. I have 40 films that I have to watch because I'm going to be a judge at the Bilbao Film Festival in 2 weeks. And I've been a judge at Sitges, and I've been a judge at Fantasia and a lot of other festivals, so I get to see a lot of films, and there's a lot of great films out there. I mean, you know, and then you see some that, you know, there was a Mexican film that was made 2 years ago called Tigers Are Never Afraid.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most brilliant films I have ever seen in my life.
I think it was in two of our top 10 lists that year, and we keep questioning why it hasn't been released.
And it doesn't get any distribution. Yeah.
But Guillermo
Guillermo's working with the director, and I think that's great. And then Coralie Fergiat, who made Revenge, which is just another absolutely brilliant, brilliant film. And I saw it first at Sitges, and when I saw it, I was the president of the jury, and I kind of beat everybody into submission. I said, this person's getting best director.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so... What she did with that movie and took a concept that we've seen, a revenge concept that's been done 100 times, mm-hmm. and she turned this victim into Wonder Woman in such a great way. And I just sat, I watched that movie. I've probably seen it 6 times now. And Coralie is just an amazing, amazing director. And, you know, and she hasn't, I mean, she's got a project going now, but she hasn't done a film since. She should have been doing a film from the day she finished post-production on Revenge. And she was up for the Bond film, but she didn't get it. And there's just, you know, there's just some great stuff. And shorts. I see great shorts all the time. Nobody ever knows the shorts. Actually, there was a short that I think played here last night, Tick, that played in front of one of the movies. It's by a young director out of Toronto. And Tick wasn't my favorite, but she did a short right before. Her name is Ashley Weasel. And I probably pronounced her name wrong. She'll be very upset when she hears this.
I apologize, Ashley.
but she did a film called Ink, which played a lot of festivals and won awards, which is really an interesting film and really well done. But, you know, there's some great production. In my 40 films that I'm watching up in my room while I'm here, I've seen some really interesting stuff. But I can't give that away because we haven't. I got to go deliberate with the other judges.
Well, we got only a few more minutes, so I think it would be cool. I'm happy to turn my mic around if people are brave enough to walk up here, and I will turn this around if we want just a couple questions, because it's rare that you get these two guys in a room, or if you have want to ask us anything, but you can also do that outside. So who would have a question and is willing to come up here? Who's brave? Yes. All right, come up here.
All right.
Take my mic. I've been drinking moonshine since 9 a.m. So. You were talking earlier about sequels, the IP franchises, and I was always curious, what is one of your favorite examples of how they do a change with it? Like, I know with mine was always been the original Planet Apes, especially starting with Escape From, where they, like you said, they did their own thing with each one. And I was wondering if there's any other samples that you thought of that fit that what you were referring to.
I don't know. Well, Escape was that was a budgetary thing, I'm sure. You know, easier to bring the apes to the real to our world today than to create a world that they're in. I don't know. I mean, there's so many. I mean, reboots, reimaginings, whatever. I mean, you know, I just what I do hate is to see announcements. Sometimes they don't get made, but announcements. Okay, Joe Blow is remaking Videodrome. It's like, huh? Why? I mean, the movies to remake. To me, would be the ones that had a great idea that was not realized, that didn't realize its potential, from whatever era. And so that if you're going to remake something, if you want to retain that IP concept, but remake something that wasn't done to its full potential the first time. If I was a Hollywood executive, I'd be fired. I'd be fired in one stockholder's quarter.
That's not profitable.
Yeah, I know. It's all about money, and it's very true. I mean, unless the original, like I said before, I was asked to do a remake of Touch of Evil, which I actually talked the studio out of ever even thinking about doing it. I mean, why?
It's like Hunter.
You know, and I mean, why take a classic film that's just wonderful? And but like Jeff said, if there's been one, but I think I'm going to break all the rules here. It's not a horror film, but my favorite sequel ever is Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm. No,
which was better than Godfather 1.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people agree with you on that.
I mean, you cheated.
Unfortunately, then they made Godfather 3.
Oh, yeah.
But, Godfather 2 is like the ultimate sequel.
No, that's the ne plus ultra of the sequels. That's like on everyone's list of best sequels or whatever, or it depends on, like, for a few dollars more you might want to put it depends on what you call a
series. Some of this the Sergio Leone pictures, and but then it was the same people making the films.
Bride of Frankenstein being a horror example of that.
Any others?
Any more questions from the audience?
Got a quick thing. How many aspiring or not aspiring, how many filmmakers are in the audience?
Good, Chuck.
All right. Hey. Well, congrats to you guys, man. Keep making them, and because there's always that one film that'll come out of nowhere that will surprise the hell out of you.
Yeah.
In every festival and every in every venue, there's always something that will surprise you and go, man, that was friggin' great.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we keep doing the show is when you discover that one, you want to tell all your friends about it.
Yeah, every couple of weeks we find one film that we're like, holy shit, you guys have to go see this now.
I do it for the money. Every time. So that's it. No more questions. This is your last chance. All right.
Quiet okay, lunch. Well, all I can say is get good scripts. Mm-hmm. Work on the script. Really work on the script.
And an addendum to that, don't be too easily satisfied. That's the only thing I find for some of the younger filmmakers. They're too easily satisfied, and they're more excited about, hey, we're shooting on a red versus what we're shooting.
Good advice, guys. That was great. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, guys, thanks for coming to the live Shockwaves here at Chattanooga Film Festival. Thank you so much, Jeff Burr and Gary Sherman, for being our guests.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Honor.
Thank you.
And we will hang out for anyone who didn't want to get up on stage and ask a question awkwardly. We'll hang out. And so if you guys want to come say hi, we'd love meeting you guys. It's always gives us the fuel to come back and do this for another year every time meeting you guys. So thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
This episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following sponsors. Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes that there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. Streaming right now on Shudder, you can catch up with Joe Bob Briggs in The Last Drive-In, see originals like Cold Hell or Sadako vs. Kayako, and the upcoming One Cut of the Dead. You can stream all these great thrillers, horror, and suspense movies for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fast, and growing human-curated selection of thrillers and dangerous entertainment anywhere. They are the Netflix of horror. To try Shudder for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast. That's S-H-U-D-D-E-R. And use the code WAVES. This episode is also brought to you by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD right now. They've got awesome releases from Vinegar Syndrome, including Darkroom, The Suckling, and Grandmother's House. All of the AGFA and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Blood Lake, and Lady Street Fighter. From Garage House Pictures, both Supercock and Foes. And also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head over to www.diabolikdvd.com or search them out on Facebook. Fangoria. In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world, and now this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. That's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want you to experience this and have it be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue 4. We're celebrating in style. Head over to fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. And if you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, which is issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off at fangoria.com. And Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror section at your local video store. Not those big, brightly lit stores like Blockbuster either, but the hole-in-the-wall shops. The shops where you could find deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to video hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that is dripping with sloppy, ooey-gooey 80s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by the New York Times bestseller author Cullen Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by the legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Saltaris, Rising Star Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedell, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker Award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic today to unlock all the super rad stretch goals exclusive only to the Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter in June. And remember to always be kind, rewind, or die. Head over to Kickstarter.com right now and search Graveyard Slaughter today.